stories of neurodivergence, yet you can't find the ones that speak to your life. Utopia the Campaign aims to platform the voices of neurodivergence across different communities and life circumstances, so we find the words to get the support we need. Join me, Samantha Hugh, Director of ADHD Girls, as I uncover hidden stories of neurodivergence that come from a few, but speak to so many parts of our lives. Hello, hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. I love that intro.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm so happy to have you here today, Evelyn. You know, I know we've been trying to get a date down in a diary and then it's finally happened, so I'm truly excited. Can I start by asking you to tell me about yourself and your role at, is it Ada and Chad?
Ada and Chad.
Yeah, and then what neurodivergence you experienced, but yeah.
Yeah, sure. Well, my name is Evelyn Polk Green. I am an adult with ADHD and also the parent of two adult sons with ADHD. And my older son also has a few other things. And I started this kind of ADHD advocacy journey with my oldest when he was 7 when he was diagnosed. And I really got involved in advocacy a couple of years later after getting myself grounded in it and figuring out what was going on and all that. I learned that I had ADHD through him when he was diagnosed, is how as we were going through the questionnaires and talking to the doctors, I realized, oh my gosh, this is me. This is what was going on with me growing up, which was tremendously helpful for me because as first of all, a woman, a girl, and a Black girl, that, when I was growing up, there was no such thing as ADHD for us. It just didn't happen. And so all the crazy things that happened while I was growing up, all the stories I made up inside of my head to make it okay with what was happening to me, it all finally like settled in. It was like, oh, there's a reason for all of this. There's a reason why I felt this way. I was very fortunate in that my ADHD did not stop me academically, and I learned coping skills very early on. Like, I can remember in first and second grade in elementary school being the teacher's pet, because if I did that, when I got done with my work, I got to be a helper. And so I would quickly get through my work because there was no way I was going to be able to just sit at a seat all day long. And so this way I got to get up and wash the boards and, run errands and help grade papers and do different things. Now, of course, I didn't know then it was a coping skill. I didn't realize that till years and years later. But I consider myself very fortunate. And again, I pretty much thrived until I hit college. I remember all of my report cards all said either she talks too much or she would just concentrate or all the things that we typically hear on an ADHD report card. But I had no idea that's what it was. I kept myself busy with lots of extracurricular activities, especially in high school. I was like the editor of the school paper and I was an ROTC and did all kinds of things, not knowing that was, again, a coping skill. And kind of when I hit college, I hit a brick wall, not having any idea what it was. I know that that was the first time I really encountered like depression, because I couldn't figure out, talk about imposter syndrome. I couldn't figure out how I got into this prestigious school, on a partial scholarship, and then was a complete failure once I got there and couldn't figure it out. So I was a mess for a few years. I will say that I was a complete mess for a few years. I think if we had known more about mental health back then, like we do now, and talked about it, I'm sure my friends would have been a lot more alarmed about me, mm-hmm. being in my dark apartment for weeks at a time without coming out and being a man. So whatever, but I got through it. I got through it. And here I am.
So. Wow. Well, such a colorful story, and really, truly actually relate to a lot of it, especially, in school.
I don't know, like there's something different about school and then going off to college, right? Because like when you go to college, you're kind of like just kind of on your own. But then when you're in school, there's always this accountability when it's the homework due to be in and there's like exams.
Exactly,
And it's so
exactly.
fast paced. Yeah. So when you go to college, it's like, who knows anything about mental health? Who knows? You know, we can't even
Anything,
talk about.
right. And I lost all that scaffolding because, my mother was a teacher, and so there was no way I was coming home with anything ever less than like an A or a B at the, at the, and so I had that structure, and when you get to college, that's all gone. And, I had no clue how to figure it out, how to, how to, and I was lucky. I had never really had to study. I did other than science and math a little bit, but not everything else, just came very naturally. And
Wow.
so, yeah, so I was very lucky until I
Yes.
wasn't
I get it. Yeah, but it
anymore.
sounds like yeah, you are really intelligent and you know things that you know came with learning kind of came quite easily to you. And I wanted to touch on something that is within the bio that you sent me, and that is that you said that you've been focused on the challenges of ADHD in minority, poor, and other underserved populations throughout your advocacy journey. Like, I'm really curious about what made you know, focus on this to begin with.
Well, you know what? It actually started when I started my advocacy journey. The way I kind of got started, and CHADD was the first organization you asked me that, and I'll kind of explain my role with both of those now. But CHADD, with children and adults with attention deficit disorders, attention hyperactivity disorder, I got started because my son's doctor was very interested and active around ADHD issues. And he said to me immediately, I live in Chicago and I live in the city of Chicago. And he said to me immediately, I've been looking for you. I've been looking for a parent like you who will start. We need a CHADD chapter in Chicago. There are lots of them in the suburbs. We need one in the city for parents who live in the city. And I was like, okay. Now, this was, he asked me for several years, but like I said, I was kind of on my own journey. And I was like, I don't, it's hard enough handling this kid. And I had a newborn. And, it was like, So when I was finally, ready a couple years later, he finally convinced me because I realized that. Where was I getting help from? I had joined CHADD, but that was kind of long distance and I wasn't going to the other chapters. So, one of the things that happens, this is kind of a long story. One of the things that happens, or that happened back then was you had to go to, if there were other CHADD chapters in your vicinity, you kind of needed to okay opening a new chapter with them because they didn't want chapters competing for membership and that kind of thing. So I called the suburban chapter that was closest to me. And what she said to me was, well, kids in the city don't have ADHD. They have behavior and emotional problems. You should come join our chapter. And I was like, what did you say? And I was floored. So I was done. I was done with Chad. I was like, nope, I'm not doing any of this. This is I these folks are racist for, coming out the gate. I'm just not even. Because of course, well, you may not know, but it did in the US, city kids or urban is it's a dog whistle for black. So in other words, she was saying, those black kids don't have ADHD. They've got and that really was kind of the mindset. Back then, I mean, that was it was 30 years ago, a little less than 30, 25, 30 years ago. And so that really was kind of like, black kids weren't diagnosed with ADHD. They were diagnosed with behavior and emotional problems. And so it took me a little while to get over it. And the doctor kept saying, see, this is why we need the chapter in Chicago. And I kept saying, I don't want any parts of those people. He convinced me. So anyway, that was my introduction to ADHD advocacy. So needless to say, my since 25, 30 year career in ADHD advocacy has been focused on those communities just because things unfortunately have not changed that much
Oh,
in that
wow.
area. I mean, I shouldn't be that negative about it because they have changed in some ways. I mean, there are lots of I have a good friend now who is an ADHD adult, Renee Brooks, who runs Black Girl Lost Keys. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's a blog, and she's got a podcast now. So, when I started, there was no way that something like that would have worked because we didn't acknowledge girls had ADHD, let alone Black girls had ADHD. So there was no way that something like that. So things have gotten better, but it's still, I mean, she and I talk all the time. There's still so much stigma. There's stigma within our community. There's like an internal kind of stigma, as well as all that we have to deal with externally and outside of the community. So there
Yeah.
you go.
Can I ask you, what are the specific challenges that you have observed from, like, say, people from socially disadvantaged background who are minorities still and have ADHD? Because I know, like, what you said about, kids don't get diagnosed with ADHD, but behavioral issues, that's probably to do with how people see other people, especially when we're
Yes.
different, right? And so what are those challenges that you have seen from your work?
Well, I mean, certainly the challenges are issues like of implicit bias when, a black kid has a behavior, a white kid has the same behavior, and the teacher attributes them differently. It's negative the way they're attributed. And we see that now. I'm an educator by profession, and so I do all kinds of trainings around that and how that works in a classroom. So that is still there. And that was one of the reasons then. That has gotten better. But then there's also I talked about there being internal stigma. And so one of the things that happens is, families of color don't always want their children to be diagnosed. They don't want them to be labeled. It's not that they don't want them diagnosed. They don't want them to be labeled because they've seen what happens to other kids when they're labeled. You get put in special ed, you never come out. And the programming is never as robust and as good. So if if your child you thought was on a college track, you're scared to death to have them labeled as anything because likely, or not, they may end up in a situation where they're not going to get the best education possible. And so that's one of the fears. I think there's also a fear in the community of kind of like we've got enough stuff against us. We've got enough battles to face. We don't need this one too. We're getting better in Black community and other communities of color about not hiding Bruno if you're from Encanto, but that about letting Uncle Bruno out of the closet and finally admitting that there's stuff going on. But it's still, I think, it's difficult to kind of like air that. You don't want to air the dirty laundry, and to make things so. Those are just two quick things that I can think of that are,
They are very like astute like observations, and obviously you've had this real life experience, but I've also heard of that happening from the people I've connected with. That there's this person I know, and he's very successful now in the film industry, and his parents had actually hid his label from him even, and so he grew up not knowing any different, and then just finding his own way
Oh,
because he actually struggled.
I can remember when my youngest son, who was not diagnosed till he was in high school, and that's a whole nother story about me feeling like a terrible mother, not recognizing signs in him when I had been doing all this advocacy work for so long. But he was not diagnosed till he was in high school. But I remember once he was diagnosed, and he was on meds and he was doing 1,000% better. And he, I remember him coming to me. And one of his good friends had been diagnosed as a kid, but his parents wouldn't let him take the meds. And he was like, "Mom, do you think you could talk to Will's parents? Because maybe now they'll let him get on meds. Because I know he'd do so much better. He's struggling, and I think it's because of his ADHD." And I'm sure that that was just one story of many, and a kid that my son knew. But yes, I have heard that before. It's not, and I hear it a lot in communities of color of folks just things like, and it's, I don't want to sound like I am being critical of these families because I'm not. I get it. that, you know, we have enough reasons to be suspicious of with all of the medical kind of historical medical malpractice really that has happened in our community. I understand why you're afraid of things like that. I remember, parents saying to me, "No way I'm putting my kids on those medications. It's genocide. It's they're just trying to kill our kids." Now, my answer to that is, do you know how many white kids are on ADHD meds? I don't think so, because they're not trying to kill their own kids. So it's, but it's, I mean, that's where we go to because we're suspicious of those kind of things, and with good reason, and with good reason.
Yes,
So.
well, Evelyn, that's really kind of like very brave, things to say as well. And I suppose it's part of your advocacy journey, where you've had to help people, in those situations. I'm really interested because through my journey of speaking to psychiatrists, who specialize in the field of ADHD and neurodevelopmental conditions, have said that it manifests differently in communities of color. And that is like instead of the things that you know about anxiety, okay, we do experience that, but a lot of it because we don't know about mental health challenges as much, like it kind of manifests as like pain in your body, and kind of chest pain and tummy aches
Yes.
and things like is it like did you like witness that or any other ways of how ADHD could manifest
Yes.
differently in minority groups?
Yeah, I do. You know what? I had not really associated. Thank you for saying that, because I had not really associated that kind of like physical pain, but definitely that to, especially with mental, depression and anxiety and all those things that often accompany ADHD. But there are also other kind of cultural things that go with it. I have really good friends who are white. One very good, I'd say she's my best friend. And she, our kids kind of grew up together, like that we call each other, their kids are called, kids call each other mom and that kind of thing. And so she has two kids also with ADHD. They're similar in ages. And so, we, her kids have stayed with me, my kids have stayed with her. And she actually took my kids one summer. I was going through a difficult issue with my ex-husband, and she kind of gave me some respite care and had my kids for several weeks over the summer. And I remember her being so angry at the way my kids were treated. Like, if they went to a store, how my boys got followed around and hers didn't. And I was like, that's why my children act differently than yours. And you talk about them being well behaved, and it's not being well behaved. It's I've had this conversation with them from day one that the talk about being black, especially a black boy, and you have to figure out a way to control those impulses. I understand that your ADHD kind of, makes you want to let it out, but you cannot because it could get you dead. Whereas with and so, we see like her kids might have a tantrum, might fall out and have a tantrum, and my kids would look and go, what are they doing? We would never do that. And so, people laugh at me when I tell stories like that, but there is a cultural, because of that, there's, a basic cultural difference. I think, again, because of that, that idea of we don't air our dirty laundry. So we don't necessarily talk about what it is. And so it, people, our children, and then as adults, we're confused about what is wrong with us. And we think that, it's a lot of negative self-talk. And so we don't achieve as much, I think, is part of it, because we don't think we can, and we don't get the help that we think that we need for things. And so I think it manifests itself differently in that way as well. And how we deal with it and whether or not we get help. I'm glad to see that more and more we're recognizing it, especially in the African American and Hispanic communities. We're recognizing that, mental health is a thing and that we need to deal with it, and it's nothing to be ashamed of. But we're not there yet, and I still see some of that kind of holding back and not getting the help we need that would make us successful and make, all that negative self-talk and that self-fulfilling prophecy, because I do believe that that happens as well and makes some of that go away. So,
Well, that's
yes.
really moving actually, and sad in some ways to think that, you know, and you were saying before that even before, you know, taking into account of ADHD, there is already a layer of oppression as caused by the way, you know, we present ourselves to, just from being born, you know, and it's tough, right, living like that and actually, you know, going into a society where other people don't know that they've had the privilege and we've had to try that much harder. Right. In the work you do, the advocacy work, what type of setting do people need your help the most?
Well, it's kind of funny because a lot of the advocacy work I did for so long was as a board member and president with CHAAD and then ADA. And so that's a different kind of advocacy work. That's talking to, about policy kind of changes and talking to legislators and that kind of thing, and not only very occasionally being able to work one-on-one with the family or something like that. So now that I'm kind of like on the sidelines from that, I mean, I still do some work, a lot of work with ADA, but not, I'm not front and center. I do get more phone calls and people do refer me more. So it may be help in with an IEP meeting, with helping families advocate with their schools about what's going on. I recently a young man was going to get kicked out of a high school because of some things that happened that they were not willing to acknowledge. They because they were not treating his ADHD properly, it wouldn't have happened had they been giving him, the accommodations and modifications and supports that he needed. And so I had to sit in kind of on his meeting where they were going to expel him and, talk about my expertise and what happens and why that would not have been a good thing and why his family would have been justified in suing the school district if they proceeded in going on. So those kind of, one-on-one, or even when, talking about placement after a diagnosis has been made, a school diagnosis, and talking about placement in, no, this child does not need to be in a self-contained classroom. They need to be with their peers, and here are the supports. Because often teachers and schools have no clue of the simple things they can do so that children with ADHD and other disabilities can be included. My work actually, personal to me, is the ADHD work, but my job incorporates advocating for inclusion of kids of all disabilities within, general ed settings. And so when I'm able to do it for a child with ADHD, then it just makes me that much happier. But yeah, it's helping teachers and schools figure out what they can do to include a child and to really include them, to not just, there's inclusion and then there's belonging. And we want these kids to really belong and to be members of a classroom. So, yeah.
That's really great. Like I was going to ask you, you know, what are the strategies that you use, you know, to get these effective results? But what you're saying about, you know, telling them that it's not a good idea to expel this person, and also what could happen if you do and they will sue you, it's probably the most effective strategy.
It's so unfortunately that we have to use kind of those tough guy whatever strategies and methods when let's just do the right thing. How about that? How about we just do the right thing for kids and families?
Yeah, well, no, exactly. And I think that a lot of the time, you know, the people who are there to talk to you don't actually hold that much power in the way things are run. And they are just like the minions in
Yeah, they are. They are. Oftentimes they are. Oftentimes they are. I've had, teachers that wanted to be helpful and were held back by, administration or being told that, don't say that because then we'll have to offer it and that, which is ridiculous. The other thing that I find more and more is advocating for adults, which is great for me because now,
Nice.
I'm in the adult world more than I'm with my work. I'm still working with kids, but the rest of my life is in the adult world. And so there are so many adults now who are being diagnosed, who are recognizing something's going on. And so advocating, helping them to find But first of all, and this is, I will say this to my dying day, it is so important to be able to find practitioners and clinicians who understand ADHD. Because if they don't, they're not going to get it. And I know so many people who have been, initially misdiagnosed with depression or anxiety or any number of things, bipolar disorder, because the therapist didn't know and understand ADHD. Thought they did, but really didn't. It's so, it manifests itself in so many ways and so differently, across individuals. And so, just like I know with autism, you often hear people say, if you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism. It's the same with ADHD. It doesn't manifest itself the same way for everybody. And so, if you don't have somebody that understands that in the diagnosis and treatment process, then that's real trouble. And so, for me, it's very important that folks find people. And if you can find somebody, I consider myself the luckiest girl in America because I found two Black psychiatrists that treated my kids and myself, who were both women, Black psychiatrists with ADHD. So you're talking about getting it. Oh, they got, I never had to explain anything to them. They totally got it. And so, when I can refer people to clinicians who I know understand or help them negotiate that, that the whole kind of getting through getting a diagnosis, and what kind of things should be happening during, that process, that's the other way that I find myself doing advocacy more now.
Brilliant. Actually, I want to expand on what you said before about, finding the right psychiatrist for your own children. Because this would interest also healthcare professionals who now know that they need to use a cultural lens to look at, the person in order to get, the right answers to the questions they ask. So what is the type of cultural lens that the psychiatrist who diagnose your children use? Like, what kind of examples of things that are different to.
Well, I think, first of all, it's acknowledging that there's going to be a difference. So you need to recognize that what might be, your automatic response or thought about something, you need to stop, take a minute, take a step back and look at it through the lens of whatever that kid's, family, and cultural situation is. And then it's learning as much as you can and acknowledging what you don't know. So, I always say this, and we used to talk about cultural competence. I think we're moving more toward cultural responsiveness now, because in my mind, you can never be competent in another person's culture. Because if you don't walk in their shoes, then you will never, you can't gain that level of competence. But you can be responsive to it and you can understand and you can go and ask questions. And even just asking the patient, how do you think this affects you culturally? What's the difference? Even that is a start. But I think, it's more than taking a class in diversity. It's having colleagues that you can bounce things off of and say. It's being able to, again, acknowledge what you don't know and to question that and to be able to ask more questions of your patients and their families. And again, going to, having friends and colleagues so you can rely on to ask those questions. I think just acknowledging that you don't know and what you think you might know, and which is hard, I think, for medical professionals, because they're just, I think they're trained to be arrogant in many ways, and to just kind of, I know it all, I'm the expert. And so to acknowledge that you're not the expert in everything, and sometimes you need to dig a little deeper and ask some more questions to figure out what's going on. And the other solution to that, which is, I guess, pie in the sky, is we need more clinicians of color. We need more doctors and psychiatrists and therapists of color that get the cultural differences. So that's another way I try to advocate, is pushing for more programs that'll get those folks in.
Interesting. So yeah, this is really what this podcast is about, really. I mean, want to increase representation, want to improve the number of stories that we hear, and this will help across all sections of society. Healthcare is a big part of it, I suppose, to get people diagnosed and get the answers they need to move on. And then obviously at school, then in the workplace, you know, this is people's livelihood. They need to have a job that they can keep, right? And do you see the principles are kind of similar in terms of...
I do, I absolutely. And people are frightened to death to it, just like, you know, families often don't want schools to know or won't, you know, allow a child to be labeled. People do not want to disclose in the workplace because they're afraid they'll be targeted, that it'll be used as an excuse to fire them. But then they struggle with so many things and their employer is not aware of it. And if they only knew, then they might be able to put some things in place for them. And I understand that. I understand why you might not, depending on what kind of work and work environment you're in, it may be better not to disclose. But, you know, one of the other things that I advocate for and try to help people do is to figure out what you can do for yourself without maybe disclosing. So what kind of, you know, tools can you use? What kind of things can you put in place? Do you have trusted people in the workplace? I, for many years in a different position I was in, I worked within Chicago Public Schools for over 30 years, but I've had various positions from being in a classroom to management positions and those. And so in one thing I had one class, and this is when I actually started, like got officially diagnosed and started using meds, is I got a promotion. I don't, now that I think about it, it wasn't much of a promotion. I mean, I got more money, but I hated the job because I went from working with people, which I'm great with, to working with paper, which not so much. Not so much. A lot of reports. And so, and that's actually when I started meds and got officially diagnosed because I was like, oh my God, I really am my kids having it here. And one of the things that I did, I never denied it. It was kind of hard to because I was in this advocacy role and everybody knew that I was like, you know, president of CHAD, president of ADA and in this role. So everybody knew. But I didn't like officially disclose to my employer. The people around me knew. And I would rely on them. I mean, and they knew. And I would say, all right, I'm gonna need your help with this. You need to come remind me or whatever it was. And they were great. I had the best coworkers. And so doing stuff, you know, things like that, strategies to get those folks who you trust around you to help, as well as putting in whatever tools, whether it's, you know, calendars or reminders or what, you know, a certain kind of planner, whatever tools you need to help you be successful. And so just acknowledging, I think for us, sometimes just acknowledging that it, you know, yeah, you don't do everything the right way. You've got some challenges. I shouldn't say the right way, but you know, you've got some challenges. So what strategies can we put in place to mitigate them as much as possible?
Right. You know, that's really interesting. I mean, you've obviously got a lot of experience in advocacy and you've helped people, I suppose, even those who don't want to say that they have ADHD at the workplace. And then like this is probably the area where people need help the most, considering we know that it's not always possible to get a diagnosis.
Yeah.
And that's so interesting because as an advocate, you know, you've been able to kind of step in and help people directly, but say if we turn it around and there's someone in the workplace who maybe want to support these individuals, you know, who might look like they're having a breakdown, but we don't know whether they have ADHD. What can we do, you know, as allies?
Yeah. Well, one of the things, it's great that more and more HR departments, you know, the human resources departments, the talent department, as we call it, where I work, are recognizing the challenges that adults have in the workplace with kind of, you know, ADHD, dyslexia, other kind of, you know, disorders or even mental health issues, and are putting things in place. They have, like, you know, the employee assistance programs. And so one of the things that I know is happening is that those folks are having experts come in and talk to their human resources folks or to their managers about working with adults that have ADHD or other disorders that may impact in the workplace. And so are talking to them about what kind of things they can do and things you put in place. So anytime I can do that, I've been asked just a couple of times to go in and lunch talks. Ada has a whole thing, a whole workplace thing that we will go into a company and talk to them about workplace issues and do some training with them to do. I know Renee, my friend I was talking about, has gone into organizations. So that's kind of like the official way you can do it, but there are also things that can they can put in place. So I would advocate for just, first of all, talking to the person and asking them to be honest about where their challenges are. Like, where can they use the help? Where do they know they need help? And if sometimes we don't even realize it. I actually had an employee. This was funny. I had somebody on my staff who had ADHD, and it was the first time that I worked with someone with ADHD. And I had to step back and say, whoa, Evelyn, you know how challenging these things are. You need to put things in place for her and not get frustrated. Because initially I was getting frustrated and I was like, why are you doing this? You know why. You don't want people getting frustrated with you. And so putting like simple things like, okay, you know what? The rest of us start at 8. You start at 9 because you are time blind and are never going to get here at 8 o'clock, no matter what. So we're just going to make your start time 9. How's that? What do you do? And so just putting things like that in place when it doesn't do anything but raise productivity. If people understood how productive folks with ADHD, I mean, I have worked for Chicago Public Schools, like I've given them way more work than they deserve to have and have worked, till 9 o'clock at night, have gone in on weekends, have done all kinds of things. If I feel like it's appreciated and I'm given the supports that I need. So, folks with ADHD, once we hyper focus, can be so productive if we just have the tools and supports and strategies that we need and aren't feeling frustrated. So helping them to understand that, I think, is helpful as well.
That's really interesting. So, like, I agree with you completely, and that's what I would say as well, because in order for someone to actually even come up to and ask for help, they need to feel safe. But what if they're in an environment where no one actually is talking about anything, and there is no knowledge, there's no encounter? Okay, they have to literally be living in a cave, basically, because we're talking about it on social media so much, and it's in newspapers. But yeah, what if that happens because that this situation exists?
Yeah, it does. And it's hard. And again, if they don't have trusted allies in the workplace, not necessarily, like a manager, but even a colleague or friend that they can kind of rely on to help them stay on track or to help, I'm not sure. Because I can't imagine being in that position. Well, I can, because my son has actually been in that position before. And I'm gonna say something that's probably going to be controversial, but I'm going to say it anyway. And it's controversial when I say it about families. One of the things that I know for saying is, it's hard enough raising a kid with ADHD than raising them with family members who are critical, who are don't understand. And so I have removed myself and my kids from folks like that within my family. Than our extended family with no qualms, because I'm like, they have enough stuff going on against them. I'm not gonna make them have to fight their own family too, and to have that internal battle. And so, it's kind of the same thing. They may need to start looking for a new position because they are never, what's gonna happen is they are gonna end up, even if they manage to be successful in terms of getting their work done, they are never going to be happy there, so they're never going to be as productive as they should be. Eventually, they're going to start breaking down and start doing things not correctly or doing things that get them in trouble with their supervisors and are going to end up being let go, which is a much worse situation. So think about, you know what? It's finding your passion. I have always advocated to my kids to do that, which now I'm think I'm regretting it because they're both also in education. And I'm like, really, guys, I wanted you to make some money in your life. You're not going to do that in education, both of them are. But I've always advocated for them to find their passion because that's what's going to make you successful. And it doesn't have to be, look outside the box. It doesn't have to be a 9-to-5 job. Find what you love and figure out a way to make it work. Because as long as you love it, then it's never work and you're going to be successful in it and you're
Oh.
going to find a way to do the things that you need to do. So I'm sure, somebody is cringing out there when we telling folks to quit their jobs, but eventually you're going to either quit or get fired anyway. So
Yeah, I feel like I'm listening to you and like actually hearing myself because I've been saying the same thing. And it's like I think the more you understand what it's like to live as an ADHD, or the more you know that sometimes you can't force a situation to
yeah.
be for you, and if it's not the right environment, you can look for another one because we need this environment to
Yeah.
grow, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Maybe what you're doing now, or any exciting plans?
No, now I'm trying to figure out the next chapter. I'm going to be retiring from my job soon in the next few years, next 2 or 3, 4 years. And I'm just trying to figure out what I'm gonna do next, what the next chapter is. I'm sure it will somehow be related to ADHD and ADHD advocacy because apparently I can't walk away. As many times as I may have tried, apparently I'll be doing this in some shape or fashion for my entire life. But no, I just, what I always say, I try to like always in everything with what I said before, find your passion. Live it, say yes as much as you can, but understand that life can be challenging and have a sense of humor. Jeez, you have to live with a sense of humor with ADHD. If there's anything that I live with people is, because stuff is gonna happen and you need to be able to laugh at it, even if it doesn't seem funny at the time, later it will. So
Gosh, wow, that's great. We need that in our lives for sure. But I totally see you on the stage. I'm sure you're already doing it, but maybe that's your next chapter where you're going to go all in that. Who knows, right? But that's cool. Really, really glad to have you today. You've been a powerhouse of inspiration and
thank you.
amazing stories, and there's always a story within a story, as we know.
Always. 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 I think stories are it. It's the way, I think it's the way we change the world is with stories. I'm always encouraging people to share your story because,
Exactly. Thank you so
yeah.
much.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What did you think of this episode? If it resonates with you, do share it so we can empower other neurodivergents too. We want to open up conversations for neurodivergents across all communities, especially the ones who are underrepresented, so they can get diagnosed and find the support they need in life and work. I'm Samantha Hugh, Director of ADHD Girls, and you can invite me to speak at your organization or subscribe to my upcoming bite-sized video courses on ADHD and neurodiversity via a new learning platform called Utopia. You can find a link via my link tree within my bio on Instagram and LinkedIn. Special thanks to QuiTech for being such a wonderful collaborator throughout phase one of this campaign.